I'm Brittany French.
Hey, I'm Rob McDonald.
And this is the Great Plains Outdoors Podcast.
We're going to talk about everything from fishing and hunting to hiking, paddling, and adventures on the Great Plains. We'll cover it all here.
So join us each episode and hear what's going on in the great outdoors on the Great Plains. Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Great Plains Outdoors Podcast. Summer is sure flying by with a lot of summer activities still to be had. I know here in Kansas, I just wrapped up my Little League baseball season. Unfortunately, I am not here to report that we are the champions of the division, but we are second place champions of the division. Go Bandits. So shout out to my great 9 and 10 year old baseball team, League 42. If you're ever interested in finding a inner city baseball league in Wichita, Kansas, that's the go-to. It's a great season. It's a lot of fun and we love baseball. So it's great. Rob, I know you've been up to a lot besides working youth rodeos. What's going on in your world?
Yeah, it is rodeo season here for my kids anyway. It seems like we are spending a lot of time horseback and pulling horses around to different saddle clubs, which is a lot of fun. And I'm with you. Summer is flying by for sure. It seems like just yesterday I was scouting turkeys and heron gobbles and, you know, trying to get birds for kids and stuff. And recently, I've kind of been looking forward to our early teal season. You know, squirrel season's open here. It's been really hot and muggy, so I haven't been out, but that first teal season and dove season kicks off in September. It seems like maybe it's around the corner. So it seems maybe early to be thinking about that, but I don't think it is.
You're right. I know we're getting close to September when I say, oh, we should connect in August. And I'm like, oh, that's like 2 weeks away.
Right?
Believe it or not. Yeah. The world is still turning with whether we're ready or not. The great thing about September is, and I think we've always talked about this on the podcast, is it's like the gateway month, right? Like we're all like a little jittery about what's happening and what's to come. And we all get really excited about hunting seasons. And one of those early seasons on the Great Plains is early grouse season. Grouse are a group of bird species that many of our listeners may not be completely familiar with, but today our guest Ted Cook is going to be helping us out with that. Ted is the executive director of the North American Grouse Partnership. Previously, Ted spent 30 years working as an endangered species biologist for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, including work supervising the Lesser Prairie Chicken Program. Welcome to Ted. So excited you're here joining us from, I think, Idaho. Is that correct?
That's right. Garden Valley, Idaho, an hour north of Boise.
Awesome. Well, we're so excited to learn about grouse, prairie chickens, and especially the lesser prairie chicken from you today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited to be here. And I just love your conversations about kids, kids, and more kids. And mine are 30 and 29 years old, my son and daughter, respectively. And yeah, you guys are, you know, living the dream in terms of having, you know, still having them at home and being able to do things like Little League and rodeo and hunting. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's a treat, let me tell you. Well, Ted, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, so I grew up in Connecticut, actually just outside of New York City. My dad took the train to Manhattan, downtown New York City, every day for 30 years. I would ride my bike 3 miles in the dark to go fishing because I was so passionate about the outdoors. And it wasn't until I was 40 years old and my sister-in-law helped me realize that, because I would ride my bike 3 miles in the dark to go fishing. I get my friends to go with me once and they wouldn't go anymore. And it wasn't until I was 40 years old, my sister-in-law was like, no, you're the weird one. Most 14-year-olds would not ride their bike 3 miles in the dark to go fishing, but you know. So anyway, I dreamed of living and working in the West as a biologist and having a beautiful wife and 2.3 children. And so I've lived the dream, and here my wife and I are now an hour north of Boise living happily ever after.
Love that.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
So life is great for us.
So 30 years working as an endangered species biologist, like that says a lot right there. You know, I mean, that's a mouthful when it's not. tell us just a little bit about that background, if you don't mind.
Yeah, so it's funny. Part of, when I was 16 years old, I knew I wanted to be a biologist. I knew there were these state fish and game agencies, and I thought, you know, I want to live and work in the West as a biologist. And so I went to school for 6 years, got 2 degrees, and moved west. But at 16 years of age, I thought there's these state fish and game agencies. Wouldn't it be cool if there was a federal fish and game? And I could, you know, work across state boundaries on interesting projects and, you know, do biology and conservation and all that. Well, turns out there is a federal fish and game. It's called the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And right out of graduate school from Idaho State University in 1990, I got a job with them and ended up staying with them my whole career and incredibly grateful and happy. And, you know, worked with charismatic megafauna in Idaho, you know, to snails, to plants, to lesser prairie chickens in southwestern Great Plains. And just super grateful. I reflect back and a lot of people's career paths, almost all people's career paths are not nearly as linear, right? From age 16 and dreaming of being a biologist working for some agency you didn't even know existed to being 58 years old now. And, you know, because I live in here in Idaho in the mountains north of Boise, and I just can't believe how lucky I've been in my life.
Yeah, that's pretty rare when your career prolongs like that, and it's everything you wished and dreamed of. And we've talked about that on the podcast too, where your career is your passion, right? Your profession is your passion. Yeah. And that's cool. You're definitely in that boat. I love it. I'm in that same camp.
Well, good for all of us, right? And yes. It doesn't happen that way. I mean, a lot of people don't know what they want to be at age 16 or 21 or whatever. But I remember my grandfather, who actually lived to be nearly 107 years of age, notably. And he used to love to visit me. Yes. Yeah. And he would say to me, Ted, you know, I enjoyed my work, but I worked, you know, to put food on the table for my family. Of course, he's born in 1900, Depression era, you know, raising kids. And he said, you get to live your passion. And he really helped me appreciate that at a younger age, you know, how lucky I've been in my life. And then, so then I retired 3 years ago from Fish and Wildlife Service, and North American Grouse Partnership Board said, hey, you know, we're looking for a new executive director. You should apply. And I said, no, thank you. And here I am. And I'm super glad to be here, of course, because what you realize in life and is there's important things to be done. And if you don't do them, you know, who's going to do it, right? And so I realized that I was probably pretty well suited for this current role with Grouse Partnership, because I spent the last 8 years of my career working on either sage grouse or lesser prairie chickens. And it requires, and the North American Grouse Partnership is a perfect group for me because it's a science-based policy advocacy group. And, you know, I've got 2 degrees in science and 30 years of policy work. So here I am trying to move the needle for lesser prairie chickens.
Perfect. So while you're talking about conservation-based policy groups, we've got a lot of backcountry hunters and anglers, listeners, members that are listeners. And I thought it might be worth mentioning that you're on the National BHA board. Is that right?
Well, North American.
North American. Okay. There we go.
Canada as well. Yeah.
Okay. Very cool.
Yeah. So I'm chair of the board for North American BHA and proud of it. And, you know, BHA is one of those groups too. I talk about living the dream. I mean, I remember finding BHA and thinking this group was made for me. You know, I love conservation and passionate about conservation and passionate about hunting and fishing, done it all my life. Actually, I didn't start hunting until I put myself through hunter's ed at age 18 and then went from there. But yeah, BHA is just the kind of group for me for protecting habitat and access and fish and wildlife and then enjoying all that. So, and I understand you're a part of the BHA community as well.
Yeah. I'm a BHA member and then I'm on the Kansas board. So appreciate all the work you're doing for us at the North American level. And we never finish. There's always plenty to do. So
yeah, and that's it's important to celebrate the successes along the way as well. And thank you for being a boots on the ground volunteer. That's what moves the needle for conservation in this world. And so it's fun to be together and have these kinds of conversations.
So with the Grouse Partnership, you know, some of our listeners maybe aren't as familiar with grouse. I know, you know, outdoorsmen and women You know, if you mention a largemouth bass, a white-tailed deer, a turkey, even a pheasant or a quail, they probably can identify that pretty easily. But, you know, to be honest, like if I'm driving down the road in my backyard, I may see some greater prairie chickens. I mean, we have those right where I'm at, and there's a hunting season in Kansas, but a lot of folks maybe don't even have that kind of visibility. So could you just give us a brief, you know, grouse 101 in general? What are we talking about? What are these birds? Where they exist? What types of grouse, you know, generally are out there?
Yeah, so grouse are gallinaceous birds, which includes all the birds you just mentioned, includes, you know, domestic chickens. So basically grouse are like a wild chicken, if you will. In fact, you know, greater lesser prairie chickens in the name. You're right, they're much less often seen or encountered, which makes them a little bit exotic. But grouse, you know, there's the North American Grouse Partnership includes all 12 North American grouse species, which include things like ruffed grouse and ptarmigan and greater lesser prairie chickens, those sorts of things. But we focus specifically on the four prairie grouse species in North America. And those include the greater prairie chicken, lesser prairie chicken, sharp-tailed grouse, and sage grouse, which we call a prairie grouse because the main thing in that those grouse have in common is they don't like tall structures, right? They don't want trees. They don't want power lines. They don't want wind turbines, that sort of thing. And so, the reason we focus on the prairie grouse is those four species are most threatened right now. Rough grouse are declining in many places, particularly in the East, due to forest management practices that do not favor ruffed grouse. But generally speaking, the prairie grouse are declining most precipitously. Your listeners should know that prairies are the most threatened ecosystem on the North American continent right now. I'll say it again, prairies are the most threatened ecosystem in North America, and that's reflected in the four prairie grouse species continually declining. And we can start the conversation with heath hens. Maybe not too many people have heard of a heath hen, but a heath hen was a prairie chicken of the East, and they became extinct over a century ago. And that was primarily due to overharvest because, you know, settlers back in the day used to shoot them and eat them. The last heath hen was actually found on Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts, coastal prairie habitats there. And they're gone. The next most endangered prairie grouse would be the Atwater's prairie chicken in coastal Texas plains. The lesson we can learn there is once you lose a prairie grouse, it's incredibly difficult to restore them. And that's because they need a large population size. They have these leks that they strut on, and you need multiple birds on multiple leks, you know, where the males will dance and then multiple females coming in and trading among leks and then going out and nesting. And it's hard to put enough birds out on the ground if they're raised in captivity and they're not savvy about how to avoid getting eaten by predators. And so that's the lesson we're learning with the Atwater's prairie chicken and other episodes we've had too. But then next in line is the lesser prairie chicken, which we expect the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to list under the Endangered Species Act any day now. We're in early July. And then even after that, you know, sage grouse have been proposed for listing under the Endangered Species Act. And you can still hunt some sage grouse in some places, but like here in Idaho, you can only take one sage grouse a day now. And I think two or three in the season. And it's like a trophy hunt. And sage grouse are incredibly cool. We can talk about hunting them. Fortunately, there's still more accessible seasons for greater prairie chickens and sharp-tailed grouse, but even their numbers are in habitat are declining as well.
Yeah, I think you definitely circled around a lot there, you know, from the declining ecosystem. So I don't know if we talked about it, Ted, but I live in the Flint Hills of Kansas. So, you know, I don't remember the statistic, but the largest intact remaining tall grass prairie anywhere in the world, and that whole song. But we have the greater prairie chickens here. The lessers are more down, you know, I don't have to tell you that in Southwest Kansas, but
that's right.
The declining in habitat, so the disappearing prairie, What's the driver that for that development? You know, somebody, yeah, you'd mentioned wind turbines, right? Or oil field or power lines. You know, if I look at a piece of prairie that has power lines on it, I mean, it's still prairie. Is it just not conducive to grouse? Is it the till, farming practice? You know, I guess, and it's probably not one thing, right?
So, yeah. So the answer to your question and the list you just gave was yes. And let me just say the Flint Hills are awesome. I've not spent much time there, but what a special place. And that still hosts prairie grouse because it lacks an extensive history of the main factor having caused declines for prairie grouse, particularly prairie greater or lesser prairie chickens and sharptails, and that is agriculture, right? Sod busting. And so native grouse need native prairie habitat. They need grasslands. And so if you break that and put in ag products, then the grouse can't survive there. Now, if you do it on the edge of grasslands, the grouse will often use the adjacent fields to feed, and which can be helpful. And so it's not like all ag, but in general, we've done such a good job in this country of turning so much of our Great Plains into commercial ag ground. Iowa is kind of the poster child, right? I was doing a podcast the other day with a couple of guys from Iowa, and they told me that historically, 80% of Iowa was prairie habitat. Today, 1% is prairie habitat. And they are almost devoid of any prairie grouse. Yeah. That's an incredible statistic. And so historically, that's been the greatest threat. But then all those other things you listed are now coming in, right? And so, and the taller the structure, the more displacement it makes grouse experience, right? So one power pole would be one thing. A string of power poles is a whole linear swath of habitat that's taken out, even though the grasses are good under, might be good underneath. But then you put up a wind farm and man, that's an even bigger swath of ground. Road development, subdivision, oil and gas wells, those are all the current threats. So the strategy needs to be to establish and develop stronghold habitats, contiguous blocks of native prairie habitat without those features so that grouse can survive.
Ted, what does that transition look like? So if you look up, lesser prairie chickens right now, they're considered vulnerable, right? Population decreasing. What's that transition look like when they do get put on the endangered species list? And what does that ultimately look like for us as hunters, conservationists, maybe just bird watchers, right?
Yeah, so great question. And the honest answer is it's variable. For example, we didn't delist bald eagles from the Endangered Species Act until they had been restored to the vast majority of their historic range, whereas other species like gray wolves have been delisted from parts of their historic range after only being restored to, say, 10%. Partly that reflects human tolerance for wolves, for example, let's say. The Fish and Wildlife Service actually listed lesser prairie chickens in the early 20 teens. And then industry groups sued to delist and won on a technicality. And then environmental groups petitioned and then sued to list again. And so here we are. And so the Fish and Wildlife Service proposed to list in June of last year. They were due to make a final decision in June 1st of this year. They've missed their deadline, but they're due to come out any day now with that final decision. And we anticipated it'll be listing because, a decade ago, they decided they warranted listing and they're only in worse shape today than they were a decade ago. I guess my answer is it's a continuum, right? I mean, there's kind of no one point in time where you go, whoops, okay, now it's time to list. It's just this long, decades long, slow decline. And at some point on that continuum, you say, okay, time to protect them.
And when you say delist, just to confirm, that means you're putting people on or putting a population on an endangered species list, correct?
Well, to list is to put them on the list. To delist is to take them off the list. So bald eagles were delisted.
They've gone back and forth now is what I gather then.
For lesser prairie chickens? Yes. Yeah. So they were listed in the early 20 teens. An industry group sued and won. So the Fish and Wildlife Service was compelled by a judge to delist lesser prairie chickens. Sorry, I went over that too fast. That's 30 years of shorthand talking.
Oh, that's okay.
So I guess a couple things to unpack there. They were listed by the federal government because they're in decline. There was certain standards of population, the ecology of the habitat that the federal system found that they warranted being listed. At the same time, we had groups, so those be like Farm Bureau groups, oil and gas. I mean, so somebody was like, yeah, we don't want you to list these because it's going to affect us economically, probably in a negative way, right? And so they spent dollars in the legal system. It's not like they just, you know, sent a postcard to a judge and said, we think this is a bad idea.
Right? So that's right.
They spent for-profit dollars in the court system. You mentioned a technicality. So the legality of the listing maybe was in question. They're now delisted. So we think that the technicalities, those legalities maybe have been resolved. And
well, the courts will decide. I mean, any decision U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service makes under the Endangered Species Act gets litigated. So this will be, you know, whatever decision comes out here in the next few days, that'll be litigated again.
Mm-hmm. So go ahead.
The technicality was that there were conservation plans that were developed at the last minute a decade ago. And the judge agreed with the plaintiffs that the Fish and Wildlife Service did not give enough weight to those new conservation plans. Well, now we have a decade to look back in the rearview mirror as to how those conservation plans worked, and they really haven't moved the needle, and the declines continue. So
I see. So I'm curious,
unlikely.
Who those players? So the Lesser Prairie Chicken, I guess we should, Kansas, Oklahoma, New Mexico, Texas? Is that kind of where we're talking about?
And it's very southeastern Colorado, exactly right. So it's western
part of Colorado,
Yeah, western Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, eastern New Mexico, southeastern Colorado, historic range. Yeah.
So the stakeholders that would have would be affected directly would be an ag producer, farm ranch, oil and gas, maybe electric product power. There's power plants there that are affected.
Yeah, less so ag folks, although certainly, you know, anytime you get a new federal regulatory program coming about, there's risk of regulation, but it's probably less likely to affect ag folks, and we can talk about why. More likely to affect oil and gas and wind energy folks.
Go into that a little bit for us. Why is it less likely to affect ag folks then?
Well, for ag ground that's already broken out, the habitat, the regulations under the Endangered Species Act do not allow take of a listed species. So once chickens are listed, you can't take them, and take includes harming their habitat. So if there's ag ground that's already broken out being cultivated, that habitat's already been taken before the species was protected, right? And the Fish and Wildlife Service actually proposed regulatory relief for those with ag ground on the edges near native prairie, saying that, you know what, if Lesser Prairie chickens use your ag ground and you hit them with your combine, it's okay. Because, you know, they're actually feeding in your fields. That's a good thing for chickens. And, you know, you'll probably grow more chickens than you'll kill with your combine. So that's an example of like regulatory relief that the Fish and Wildlife Service has already proposed. And so that's why, you know, ag might be less affected there. When it comes to ranching, ranchers and cows benefit greatly from the very same native prairie habitat that Lesser Prairie chickens need. And so that old saying of what's good for the herd is good for the bird. We're good for the bird is good for the herd really applies in this situation. Now, overgrazing can harm chickens, but it's unlikely to result in a negative regulatory outcome because in my experience, you know, doing this for 30 years for the Fish and Wildlife Service, if you want to prosecute somebody for taking an endangered species, the Department of Justice's first question to the Fish and Wildlife Service is going to be, where's the dead body? And if you overgraze your ranch, you know, it's not a chicken's not going to tip over in the middle of your field suddenly from overgrazing, right? So that's just not a regulatory nexus, is kind of the legal word, right? So I don't, my personal opinion, my experience is ag practices are less likely to be affected by regulation. And in fact, ag producers have a lot more to offer on the upside. And there's many incentive programs like USDA Farm Bill programs designed to do exactly the kind of things that chickens and ranchers need. So that whole thing is, to me, that's a upside. That's a positive. And I'm sure like Farm Bureau, you know, is probably a lot more scared than I am, but, and that's fine. That's good, is that they can be a reality check on the kinds of things that I'm saying and thinking here. But when it comes to oil and gas and wind energy, those often require federal permits. So there's a federal nexus. And so there's a, and when you put in, you know, a tall structure, you take chicken habitat. It's pretty clear. The science is clear. And so the regulatory burdens are probably going to affect those industries relatively more. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So I guess let me summarize that, right? So big picture is the farmland's already, like what you said, it's taken, right? Yeah. And so they're kind of godfathered into this regulation, whereas oil industry, everything else that's like now coming forth, that's going to be a different process.
Very good.
Okay.
And rancher have the most to offer on the upside to the lesser berry chickens.
So right. Right.
That's a positive. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They're definitely providing, you know, I'm from Western Kansas, so I see this often with all of our farmers and ranchers out there. You know, they try to do everything they can to restore some of that prairie out there because they understand why they have to. They've seen the landscape turn year after year when they were young growing up in the combine with their dad. And so forth, that it's changing really rapidly. And we have to, you know, we have to leave room for our habitat.
Amen. That is exactly right. And that's what I think your listeners should really appreciate, is how much, you know, these folks who live on the land love the land. They love wildlife. They love lesser prairie chickens. And in fact, it's notable that our strongest remaining population of lesser prairie chickens left today occurs in Western Kansas on 30-year-old CRP ground, because those landowners 30 years ago worked with the Farm Bill programs to conserve native grasslands. And so let's do more of that, right? Let's do more of that. So we have a precedent. We have, you know, there is hope. We've done this before. We can do it again.
Yeah. The question I always get asked is like, well, where have all the birds gone? Where have all the birds gone in Western Kansas? I'm like, well, we got to look at the landscape.
So let me speak to that. That's a perfect observation, Brittany. And you guys may not have heard of something that's referred to commonly as the 3 billion bird study.
No, I'm unfamiliar.
All right. So this really points to the need to conserve grasslands and how much they've declined in comparison to other habitats. So scientists come out with a study recently looking at bird declines over the last 50 years in different ecosystems. The ecosystem in North America with the greatest decline in bird numbers over many different species is grasslands or prairies. Over the last 50 years, birds have declined 40% in prairie habitats in North America. That's incredible.
Whoa.
Now, can you guys name the one habitat type in North America where bird numbers actually increased slightly over the last 50 years?
I don't think I could. Rob, what about you?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, urban sprawl has grown, so I don't know if that's like sparrows and city park birds or.
Ooh, that's actually my guess. That's a good thought. But if you're a hunter, you might think about what you like to hunt. One of the birds. So wetlands and ducks, right? Mm-hmm. So wetland birds have increased over the last 50 years. Why is that? Because we have protections for wetlands. We've restored wetlands. We have groups like Ducks Unlimited and others that work hard to, you know, protect the duck factories in the northern Great Plains. And we have a law called the North American Waterfowl Conservation Act that empowers, it's like a complement to Farm Bill programs, but specific to wetlands. So, so they go to the prairies, you know, where there's farmers and ranchers and say, man, this is some of the wettest ground. You know, how does that working out for you? And the farmers and ranchers are like, man, that's such a pain in the butt. I can only farm it once every 3 years. And, you know, and then I time it wrong and it floods. And so the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has worked with those landowners to protect those habitats. We protected wetland birds. They've increased. And so that's another thing. There's a bill in development right now called the North American Grasslands Conservation Act that would work a lot like the North American Wetlands Conservation Act to protect prairie habitats. And so when that comes to Congress, we're going to be advocating strongly for that. We've actually been working behind the scenes with some different senators to try to get introduced this year.
I was going to say, is that on the docket then? Is that coming sooner than later?
Well, not yet. It's, midterm elections are near, and so it's the silly season. And so Senator Wyden from Oregon has drafted a bill. He's been looking for a Republican co-sponsor, and there's been several Republicans interested, but not willing to pull the trigger because I think it's too close to elections. And so it may get introduced this year, may not, but if not, then hopefully next year we can pick it up and work to get it across the finish line. So 50 years from now, our children can be celebrating the fact that grassland birds increased since 2022.
That would be fantastic.
Yeah, your kids playing Little League will
exactly see as many
more birds. Yeah.
But Ted, I'm curious. I'd like to circle back a little bit and talk about the habitat needs of these birds. And so you'd mentioned like vertical structure. So I'm curious, you know, I spent a fair amount of time in, I grew up in Northwest Kansas. I live in Southeast Kansas. I kind of travel around the state, hunting birds, fishing, whatever we're doing, move up, you know, spent some time up in the Dakotas last year, across Nebraska. When we talk about vertical structure that affects these birds, like cedar encroachment, for example, we see that all over the place. Other, you know, locusts, just even like noxious weeds. I know we're in the Flint Hills where I'm at, we struggle with Cerisa lespediza. I know in Western Kansas, they have issues with cheatgrass and thistle. So if we have a block of CRP, for example, say, you know, a full section, 640 acres goes into CRP on a ranch somewhere, and those invasives start to crowd in, what does that look like? So an outsider might look at that and see, well, there's some mixed cedar trees and there's some noxious weeds, but you know, that looks like a prairie to me. Does that look like a prairie to a prairie grouse?
You know, you guys know your stuff. This is awesome. So great question. And you said cedar trees, right? And so NRCS really has fine-tuned their programs in this part of the country, really specifically to get at cedar encroachment for that exact reason that you just brought up. So, and then other invasive species, invasive grasses, cheatgrass, you know, can cause problems. You know, prairies need fire to maintain themselves. One big reason is that it burns back cedar trees, right? But cheatgrass is a fire-loving, exotic invasive annual grass that can come in after fire and dominate a site and also ruin the habitat. So yeah, there's a really, really tension there, you know, and how it is that we're going to conserve these prairie habitats. But if you see a structure taller than 5 feet, if you see many structure, you know, cedar trees taller than 3 feet, that's, if the grouse haven't left already, they're just about to. And the good news is you take that out, they come back quick. And so again, you know, we know what to do. We know how to do it. We've got tools. And the NRCS is, like I say, they've been building programs to get at these issues. What the Grouse Partnership advocates for is a more strategic, focused, and sufficient application of these programs. So instead of saying, oh, you know, opening up a program countywide and waiting for landowners to come in the door, you go knock on the right landowner's door and offer them enough money to do the job. Because these landowners, and Brittany, you said this a minute ago, I mean, they love growing beef. They love healthy soils and native vegetation. They love clean air and clean water. And they can sequester carbon and they can grow wildlife habitat. They love wildlife, okay? But the only thing they can effectively monetize commercially is beef. And so we've got to find ways to pay these landowners for all these other incredibly important values that we Americans want, right? And so these Farm Bill programs, it's not a handout from the government to landowners, quite the opposite. It's the landowners generously providing all of these benefits to society, and then we're trying to find a way to pay them for it. That's really the way we need to think about this.
Yeah, that's a pretty powerful statement, because as I hear you talk about all these things we have in place, or, you know, programs, like you said, we have in place, it's like, who's actually controlling all those programs? And who's like, who's making sure all these things are actually happening, so we don't get to the point where we're now endangered and we're backtracking, you know, like you said, 30 years from now, where we don't have birds to celebrate.
That's right. And you said it, you know, I mean, NRCS does a good job. Landowners do a good job. You know, state agencies do a good job. Fish and Wildlife, they all do a good job. But if we're not, if we don't get better at being strategic and focused and coordinated, we'll continue. The evidence demonstrates our current efforts are insufficient. But for that 30-year-old CRP moment, our efforts aren't moving the needle in the right direction. And so that's where Grouse Partnership is really advocating that we, you know, come together to be more strategic and focused.
So what does that look like for you guys? I'm curious, like when it comes to like litigation of these things, are you like in it? Or are you guys more research side of things? That makes sense?
Totally. No, we are not the litigation arm. There's plenty of environmental groups out there and industry groups that occupy those spaces on either end of that spectrum. Mm-hmm. Again, we're a science-based policy advocacy group. And so what we're doing specifically for chickens right now is we've assembled landowner leaders across the five lesser prairie chicken states that we mentioned, who are truly passionate about growing beef and saving lesser prairie chickens. And they know that they can do both because they've done it on their land. And we're assembling this about a dozen landowners across these five states and reaching out to the agency saying, we've got to talk. these programs aren't working for me in the ways that they need to work in the right places in the right times. And we need to have a conversation about why and what changes we need to fix them. But again, it's not just about federal programs. One of our landowner leaders is really passionate about private programs. And so we hear about things like carbon markets, right? What does that mean? Well, it means that a rancher can grow a bunch of grass on their ground that sequesters carbon and helps slow climate change. Well, so the idea is to develop a market where, say, an oil and gas company can pay a rancher to sequester carbon to develop more oil and gas resources and get it to market, right? And that's a great idea. And that creates a private market, right? It's not a government program. We can do the same for wildlife habitat. We can do the same for clean air and clean water and soils. And so Grouse Partnership really has a strong interest in that, because a lot of these landowners in these states we're talking about, you know, they're pretty politically conservative folks, and they're uncomfortable being painted as taking government handouts. Now, we already talked about why that's not the right way to think about it, but still, you know, government programs shouldn't be the only answer. We need to develop these private markets for these values that these generous landowners provide for all Americans.
Ted, this is all like really great, empowering, educational stuff. I appreciate all you do, and I appreciate everything the North American Grouse Partnership is doing too. I mean, and I think this is a great podcast to let listeners know too. Go check you guys out. Go read more about what you all are doing and how they can play an active arm in this process.
Well, thank you. And I feel like I've been pretty policy heavy. I hope it's not been too much for your listeners, but I'm pretty passionate about moving the needle. Yeah, good.
It's fantastic.
I think we can lighten it up a little bit. You know, we're talking about the disappearing prairie and the disappearing birds, but you know, like we talked about with BHA, you know, we need to celebrate our successes and still have fun with it. So if you're up for it, we've got our infamous lightning round. And I'd kick that off.
Hear the music.
Yeah, we got eight questions that are just kind of a this or that, yes or no. Don't need to put too much thought into it. And I'll start off if you're ready.
Sounds great. I'm excited.
Okay. Number one, you know, you get to spend a weekend trip someplace. You're going to go to tall grass or woodland?
Ooh, woodland.
Okay. Number two, you're hunting upland birds, could be prairie chickens, rooster pheasants, quail, whatever birds you're into. Would you prefer to hunt over a pointer or a setter?
A lab.
A Labrador. Hey, all right.
You're speaking man after my own language. Heart.
Yeah, I'm a Labrador man.
Okay. I hope that's an okay answer.
That's perfect. That that's the best answer.
You don't discriminate against hunting dogs. All are welcome.
Number three, so you're on an upland hunt. Are you going to pull on a pair of brush pants or upland chaps?
Brush pants,
okay. Number four, you've got to choose for next season kind of your dream trip, and you have to choose between watching the spring grouse mating ritual, whether that's at a lek or in the North Woods, you know, some place like that, or a fall grouse hunting trip, one or the other?
Spring lek. There's nothing like sage grouse on the lek.
Okay. On a bird hunt, upland birds, you're going to be packing a 12 gauge or a 20 gauge?
12 gauge for now, but 20 gauge in the future.
Okay.
I like that.
So from some internet sleuthing I did to kind of get ready for this podcast and kind of scoping you out, like on LinkedIn and some places, I saw that you lived in the desert for a while. You currently live in the mountains. You've done work across the grassland. So you're living in the mountains now. So I think I know the answer, but you know, you're going to plant roots, settle down. You're going to spend that time in the mountains, in a desert, or a grassland landscape?
Well, mountains, where my wife and I bought 12 and a half acres 3 years ago and were the process of restoring native plants.
Okay. Number seven, we talked a little bit about when you were young, you'd ride your bike to go fishing. But then you'd mentioned that when you were older, you put yourself through hunter safety and started that venture. So, you prefer it, let's say it's a beautiful fall day, the fish are biting. But there's also fantastic hunting opportunity and you've got to pick that day. You're going to go angling or hunting?
My idea of heaven is September 20th on the side of the mountain with the golden aspens and a bull elk bugling in the bottom with a bow in my hand.
Okay.
At 9 a.m. So that's what I'll be doing.
I really thought you were going to say it was riding your bike uphill both ways with a fishing pole at dark.
Yeah. That's how it was back in the day. You're right.
Okay. Number eight, final question. And I think maybe you just answered it. Pick one of the three: big game hunting, bird hunting, or small game hunting.
Yeah, big game.
Okay.
Bow hunting elk, man. That's yeah, my passion.
The yeah, dream, huh?
Those rutting bulls, yeah, screaming, and you can smell them, and yeah, that's a passion.
I got to say, the first time I ever called a bull into myself, he came in 12 yards away, turned broadside, was screaming. I was hunkered down in this little hole, peeing on himself. I had a buddy with me and just going crazy. And pretty soon he wanders off and my buddy and I look at him, the first time it ever happened to us in our lives. And we're like, that was amazing. That was incredible. And my buddy asked me, so why didn't you shoot? And I said, oh my God, I forgot.
I forgot that part. Yeah. It was too much.
That's how compelling a moment that is.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's incredible.
Well, Ted, how should people connect? You know, what should they be following? Social media, you know, what do we need to check out? You know, steer our listeners in the right direction to learn more about what you're doing.
Yeah, so thanks for that. So grousepartners.org is our website, and we got Facebook and Instagram presence as well, North American Grouse Partnership. Please connect with us, become a member. And then if you want to advocate to stop the loss of prairie habitat, the most threatened ecosystem on the continent, then please reach out to your elected representatives and tell them that. And you can ask for them to do things like make sure farm bill programs are doing what they need to do to stop the loss of prairies. You can tell them to please support right now, Recovering America's Wildlife Act is going to be going to a floor vote, I think, in the House and the Senate. I'm not exactly sure where we are in the process, but it looks like it could pass this session. Recovering America's Wildlife Act will fund state agencies to conserve non-game species, which, again, really important. We stopped hunting lesser prairie chickens 20 years ago. They continue to decline because the threat was not hunting. It was habitat loss. But once they stop hunting, and state agencies can't have a hard time working on them because they can't spend hunters' dollars on a non-game species. Yeah. Recovering America's Wildlife Act would fix that. It would allow the states, like Kansas, agency in Kansas and elsewhere, to work on things like lesser prairie chickens. So call your elected representatives, promote farm bill programs, promote Recovering America's Wildlife Act this year, and then probably next year, promote North American Grasslands Conservation Act. Please speak out. The squeaky wheel gets the grease.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Cool. Absolutely. Ted, thank you so much for joining us. You've been a blast to talk with. And as we were talking before the podcast recording, I think we could probably sit here for a few hours and shoot it back and forth. And I just love that. You got a ton of experience and thanks for sharing some of that with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. You guys are bright, happy faces and family folks and passionate conservationists. And it's just a joy to be with you.
Yeah, it's been fun. So I always try and close out our episodes and encourage our listeners to do, I think what you just said, Ted, and that is to go find an organization that you're passionate about, whether that's Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, North American Grouse Partnership, Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever. Those organizations do amazing work. Also be sure and go check out the greatplainsoutdoors.com. And check out what we've got going on over there. You can listen to these podcast episodes, see the latest articles that we've got up about everything on the Great Plains Outdoors.
Absolutely. In the meantime, you guys enjoy the episodes we've posted and get out there and enjoy the Great Plains.
All right. See you guys.
We'll see ya.
Bye.